contributions for the family of Chet Jackson, you can do that by sending via his sister Kim Jackson at P.O. Box 4499, New York, New York 10185. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Stay tuned for Health Action.
Welcome to Health Action. I'm Bob Lederer in the studio with my co-host, Kathy Davis. And this afternoon, we have a two-part program. In the first half, we're going to look at the question of industry manipulation of health issues and how a wide range of extremely powerful corporations has a tremendous influence over our perception of the scientific aspects of health questions that have a tremendous effect on threats to our health and how we perceive them. And then in the second half, we're going to continue with our coverage of the ongoing crisis at WBAI and with a particular eye towards some of the historical context throughout the Pacifica network that have brought us to the moment that we are at today, as well as some updates and information about events that are happening in the New York City and Washington area. So why don't we go directly to our first segment? We are going to be speaking to the author of a very exciting new book that's just out this week that's called Trust Us, We're Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future. And the co-authors of this book are Sheldon Rampton and John Stauber, and this is a book published by Penguin Putnam. And the book goes into the powerful role of the public relations industry and how they have acted at the behest of industry, of a range of industries, in order to shape our perceptions. And we're joined now on the phone by one of the two co-authors, Sheldon Rampton, who is the co-editor of the newsletter PR Watch, Public Interest Reporting on the PR Industry, which is published by the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin. And Sheldon is also the co-author, again with John Stauber, of two other books, Toxic Sludge is Good for You and Mad Cow USA. Sheldon Rampton, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, why don't you start by telling us what your research over the last few years has found in, as far as the powerful role of the PR industry, and in particular the kind of guns for hire that seems to be coming rampant within the scientific community as a way to shape perceptions of the public about the safety or lack of safety of particular products and particular industrial practices.
Well, John and I specialize in writing about manipulative and deceptive practices of the public relations industry. Not all PR is deceptive, of course, but that's the part we write about. And one of the common threads we find running through a lot of the deceptive PR campaigns is something that is referred to in the PR industry as the third-party technique. The third-party technique has been summarized by one PR executive as put your words in someone else's mouth. The idea is that, for example, if I wanted to get you to buy my book, I would hold it up and repeat the title a whole bunch of times and tell you what a great book it was. And that probably would not be very effective if it came from my mouth, because you'd say, well, that's the author, and he's obviously trying to sell his product. Whereas if I were to get some independent source, such as a book reviewer, for example, to say the same thing, and it looked like the message did not come from me, you might be more inclined to accept it. Well, the industry does the same thing when it puts its words in the mouth of a third-party expert. So, for example, if Exxon tries to tell you that global warming is not a problem, you're going to say, well, why should I believe them? They're the company whose product is causing the problem. But if you see someone who appears to be an independent scientist, an independent third party, you're more likely to accept that message. In the case, and the techniques for doing this have become very refined in some cases. One thing that I don't think many people realize is that, for example, pharmaceutical companies are routinely in the practice of hiring ghostwriters to write articles for peer-reviewed medical journals. And these ghostwriters write up what a great drug this company's product is and how it's better than anything else currently in use. And then they go out and they find a name brand researcher. They ask that guy to edit this article that they've written to their ghostwriters. And it receives fairly minor scrutiny from this name brand researcher who's been asked to edit it, and then it goes into a leading medical journal with the name of the name brand researcher on it as the author. So in the case of Fenfan, which was taken off the market a couple of years ago after it was linked to heart valve damage, this was exactly how the company that makes Fenfan had gone about marketing the product. And when it came out that the article that one of these leading researchers had written had actually been commissioned by Wyeth Ayers, the maker of Fenfen. The researcher himself, this university professor, this MD, was very shocked. And he said, this kind of makes me uneasy. He himself did not know that Wyeth Ayers had commissioned the article with his name on it promoting Fenfen, which was published in a leading medical journal.
Now, one of the more insidious examples that you give in your book of this increasing trend towards using so-called independent or objective sources to give a stamp of approval to a particular corporate practice is the role of nonprofit medical organizations supposedly representing patients. And you give the two examples of the American Heart Association and their relationship with Bristol-Myers Squibb, and the American Cancer Society and their relationship with SmithKline Beecham. These are both powerful, large pharmaceutical companies. Tell us a little about those incidents.
Right. Again, this is a use of the third-party technique. But what the public is intended to come away with is the impression that these prestigious nonprofit organizations, such as the American Heart Association, the American Cancer Society, and so forth, are endorsing the product in question. And, I mean, you can walk into the cereal rack of your grocery store and you will see the logo of the American Heart Association on the boxes of cereal. And it's not even on the healthy cereal. It's on stuff like Lucky Charms and Cocoa Puffs and Count Chocula, basically marshmallow and chocolate and sugar with a little bit of cereal added. The intention of when they put that logo on there is to create the impression that this product meets some health standards. In fact, all it really means is that the American Heart Association has been paid by the cereal manufacturer. There's some kind of dissemblance that goes on within the nonprofit organizations themselves. The PR industry, trade press, talks about how to set up these deals, and it says when you go to one of these nonprofit organizations, don't tell them you're asking them to sponsor the to endorse the product. Tell them you're asking them to participate in a partnership, or that you want to sponsor them. But the impression the public gets when it sees this sort of thing is the impression it creates is that this product has been endorsed by the organization. And as you said, it's not just for cereal, but for Bristol Myers Squibb paid $600,000 to the American Heart Association to use the AHA's name and logo in ads for their cholesterol lowering drug. Two different drug companies paid the American Cancer Society and the American Lung Association a total of $3.5 million for the rights to use their logos on their anti-smoking aids. And, this sort of thing is quite common.
Now, one of the areas where the battle over spin, if you will, is becoming most acute is in the area of processed foods, and a whole series of controversies that have erupted in the last decade or so concerning such areas as the pesticide Alar in apples and the growing use of genetically engineered foods, and then more recently the huge public outcry in Europe over mad cow disease. And you address this in your book, and you mentioned that in Europe the public's concerns in this regard are particularly acute as a consequence of the mad cow disease scandal in England, which erupted in 1996 when government ministers and scientists reversed more than a decade of denial by admitting that a fatal brain disease in cows had begun to infect humans. Formerly known as bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE, mad cow disease kills its victims by filling their brains with microscopic sponge-like holes. And you go on to explain the history, and of course you've co-authored an entire book on called Mad Cow USA. Now, this story continues to percolate through the U.S. media, and indeed on Sunday in the New York Times, there was this front-page story. As panic over the spread of mad cow disease grips Western Europe, American health officials say they have been taking stringent steps to prevent the disease from taking hold in the United States. The brains of sick cattle are routinely tested for the disease. Imports of beef and certain beef products are banned. And then it goes on to say, to have a quote, "We are doing our best to not be complacent," unquote, said Dr. Linda Detweiler, a veterinarian with the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, pointing out that some European countries were sure they had no risk, but now find themselves caught up in the epidemic. She said, quote, "We have tried to learn from their mistakes." Now, I find this an interesting turn of a phrase and an interesting way of discussing this subject because, and this is what I want to ask you, is hasn't the pattern up till now been that both in the European governments and the U.S. government spent many years denying that there was a problem until the evidence became overwhelming?
Yeah.
And I guess my question in relation to your most recent book is, and what have been the role of these so-called independent third-party experts in reassuring the public that there's nothing to worry about?
Well, time and time again, what they've done is they've trot out independent experts, whether it be a scientist affiliated with the USDA or with agribusiness, who says, yes, we've taken extremely stringent measures. They're always talking about that. If you actually read that piece in the New York Times, the headline, I think, is a little too optimistic when it talks about stringent regulations having been put in place, because the text of the story is quite good and explains that those stringent regulations are not actually being observed. So in about half of the rendering plants which process animal proteins into feed, they're not doing the necessary separation to make sure that cattle parts are not being turned into feed to be fed to other cattle, which is what caused the disease to spread in England. So So aside from the headline, the reality is that these stringent regulations are not doing what they should in this country to protect the public health. But they'll bring out someone like Linda Detweiler, who will talk about how they've tested a whole bunch of cattle brains and they haven't found the problem here yet, which is possibly true. But the nature of this particular disease is such that by the time you find the first infected cow in the United States, it's much too late to stop the epidemic. This is a very slow moving disease, and by the time you detect the first case, it's like trying to stop a train that's already careening down the track. And so talking about how they've tested these brains is really kind of spin. And the interesting thing, the reason we wrote a whole book about mad cow disease is because it's kind of an amazing example to us of how far industry and government will collaborate in that kind of spin until it literally spins out of control, and they've got a major crisis on their hand, and the industry that they themselves are trying to protect is devastated in the process. In England, the people who ultimately suffered the worst were the farmers who lost their livelihoods when the public stopped eating beef after the government had to reverse, like we said, more than a decade of denial.
Well, perhaps a slight correction. The people who suffered the worst were those who died of mad cow disease. But
Well, that's certainly true, yeah.
The second worst were those who suffered economic losses in the beef industry.
Well, a number of farmers actually committed suicide when they lost their livelihood. So, yeah, you're right, though. The people who are actually dying from Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease are the first and victims who suffer the most.
But I think what's interesting about this example is that many people in this country are schooled and trained through the media to view the more scientific government agencies, the USDA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and so forth, as neutral and objective. And if they come out with a statement saying that a certain product or a practice is safe, that we can rely on that. And isn't part of the direction of your research to say that in many cases this simply becomes another form of cover for industry propaganda, and that can happen through different channels, whether it's the influence of campaign contributions on a presidential election that then influences the appointees to these government agencies, or whether that's sitting on a government advisory committee or having the people who sit on that committee have direct conflicts of interest with industry, or maybe you can tell us some of the other mechanisms by which government becomes a mouthpiece for industry.
Well, you hit on some of the important ones. One of the other ones is that just as there is a sort of revolving door between government and industry in other areas, there is a revolving door involving scientists who move back and forth between posts with a government agency and doing research for some company. And between that and the fact that industry is very, very diligent at making sure that its representatives are amply represented on any risk assessment committees, industry's point of view tends to prevail in the way discussions over regulations get discussed. Consumer groups and environmental groups are basically like children pressed at the door trying to hear inside while the conversation's going on, and if they scream and shout really loud, then maybe they'll be invited inside to take a peek. But really, the powers that control things are government and industry, and really it's industry controlling government.
Now, for a final example, let's talk about the most controversial issue today concerning our food supply, and that is genetically engineered food. There's a real propaganda campaign going on to say that genetically engineered food has been found to be totally safe. There's absolutely nothing to worry about. Anyone who is raising these concerns is just paranoid. What have been the role of these so-called independent experts in mobilizing public opinion in support of the biotechnology industry?
We devote a chapter in Trust Us, We're Experts to discussing the controversies and issues related to genetically modified foods. And in particular, we look at the case of Arpad Pushkai in England, who is the researcher with the Rowett Research Institute, who came out with findings a couple of years ago that rats fed genetically modified potatoes had some health problems. The minute he said anything publicly about these findings, he was fired from his job. There was a gag order imposed on using terms of his contract with the Institute, which said, they basically told him, if you talk to the press, we're going to take away your pension. His wife, who also worked for the Institute, was not even allowed to have her photograph taken by the media. And meanwhile, the Institute and industry groups put out completely factually false information about the nature of his research, which created the impression that he had gotten his facts wrong in describing his research. Some of them went even so far as to suggest that he was suffering from senility, and his reputation was destroyed. He was not allowed to speak publicly about this for the better part of a year, and he was accused, among other things, of violating every canon of scientific ethics. You could contrast that treatment of him with, for example, some corporate-funded scientists who were commissioned to come up with research defending genetically modified corn last year, when it was found that genetically modified corn is toxic to monarch butterflies. The industry-funded scientists were instantly pressed into service to do research which would refute that, and before they had even completed any of this research, they held a symposium to discuss their findings. So on the one hand, a scientist like Pushkai, if he comes out with results that are inconvenient to industry, is accused of violating every canon of scientific ethics for talking publicly about his findings. And on the other hand, industry-funded scientists who talk publicly about findings based on research which has not even been done yet are welcomed. And that's kind of the double standard that exists today in discussing this issue.
Now, let's talk for a couple minutes about the flip side of the issue of the industry using its bought and paid for experts, and let's talk about genuinely independent experts that are provided by the increasing network of grassroots advocacy groups, whether that's in areas of environmental health or challenging genetic engineering or many, many other issues, the safety of drugs and so on. Tell us what the role is of these independent groups, and particularly what has been the importance of such independent media as the Pacifica Radio Network in providing a venue to offer another viewpoint to the industry propaganda.
Well, I think it's always very important to have independent voices that are going to challenge the consensus. One of the things we talk about in Trust Us, We're Experts is the history of industry-funded science with regard to lead poisoning and the use of leaded gasoline. And there's a case where industry was actually able to create a scientific consensus that lasted for more than 50 years to the effect that the lead in leaded gasoline was not toxic to and was not harmful to public health. And the reason they were able to do that is because no one challenged them, because there was no alternative voice. So the industry-funded scientists went out, they had their say, and the public health community and government scientists basically just went with it. And it wasn't until a couple of decades ago that this consensus began to crack under the weight of the evidence. When you don't have an alternative point of view, then that's what happens, and that's why I think it's very critical for people to seek out alternative sources of information which are going to challenge the status quo.
Well, in particular, the Pacifica Radio Network has been a venue that has provided a lot of coverage on of that alternative viewpoint on health and scientific issues. And there's been increasing indications from activists all over the country that voice is being pressured and moved in a direction to try to limit free speech at various stations around the country. And I know there have been some news producers at WBAI who've expressed concern over such reports on the Pacifica National News, as one about genetic engineering several months ago, which was virtually entirely from the industry's point of view and put forward a spokesperson who ridiculed the concerns and fears of consumers. And I'm just wondering how you see the struggle for the direction of the Pacifica National News, and more broadly the Pacifica Radio Network, and the increasing role of corporate representatives on its board of directors.
I think that's very disturbing. I'll just tell you that out here in Wisconsin, where I live, you'd be surprised at how many people I know who are not particularly radical political people have come up to me and said that they heard, for example, that exchange that took place a while back between Amy Goodman and President Clinton. You know, there's a case of, you know, of someone actually asking him questions that he doesn't usually get asked, and putting him on the line and bringing something out of the President of the United States that the rest of the media never manages to get from the guy. And so much of the corporate media is locked into a model of reporting that is inclined to not make waves and not to ask challenging questions, that I think it's going to be a great loss if the corporate interests you describe are successful in eliminating that spark of independence at Pacifica.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Sheldon Rampton, the co-author, along with John Stauber, of the brand new book, Trust Us, We're Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future. And Sheldon, I know John is going to be doing a book reading at, I believe, is it Barnes & Noble here in New York next Tuesday?
That's right. I'll be there as well.
Okay, very good. And how can people get more information on the Center for Media and Democracy that you are involved with?
We have a quarterly publication, as you mentioned earlier, that monitors the public relations industry. It's called PR Watch. And we also have a website called www.prwatch.org. In addition to back issues of our newsletter, we've posted the full text of our book, MadCal USA, there, which people can download for free so they don't have to buy it anymore, although I certainly hope someone will.
Okay, very good. Thank you again, Sheldon Rampton.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and we'll be back with our second segment on the crisis in the Pacifica Network and WBAI after this musical break. Stay tuned.
to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. This is Health Action. My name is Kathy Davis, and I'm in studio with Bob Lederer. And I just wanted to remind you that we have an opportunity to get together and talk and go over some of the issues we've been discussing over the air. On Wednesday, January 17th, from 4 to 7 p.m., there's going to be a rally outside of WBAI Studios at 120 Wall Street, and that's all the way over by the river. On Friday, January 19th, at noon, there'll be a rally outside the offices of Epstein, Becker, and Green, and that's the law firm of Pacifica board member John Murdop. The address is 1227 25th Street. Oh, I'm sorry, that doesn't seem to be the right address. But also on Sunday, January 21st, 1 p.m., there's going to be a rally at Pacifica National Headquarters, and that's 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, and that's in Washington, D.C. Okay, so those are some the three rallies that are coming up, and for more information, you can call 800-825-0055. That's 800-825-0055.
Okay, and again, on Health Action, this is Bob Lederer, and we're now going to discuss the latest in the saga of the crisis at the Pacifica National Network and WBAI. I just wanted to begin with a bit of an update of events in the last week. It has been a dizzying array of acts of repression and censorship, both here and in other stations, that continues. The pattern has been going on for upwards of 6 to 8 years in some of the five stations of the Pacifica National Network. Just a quick roundup of recent developments. On Monday, WBAI producer Peter Beauchamp announced on the air that his work had been censored. A 25-year WBAI veteran and award-winning producer, Beauchamp had dropped off his year-end highlights reel to be played on New Year's Day, and it was played three times, as always in this annual tradition, the first time without any alteration of content, the second time on Democracy Now, after Amy Goodman made one minor edit for which she got Beauchamp's explicit consent, but the third time the program aired during Beauchamp's own time slot, although in his absence, because he was not able to be at the station. According to Beauchamp, several alterations to his program were made in this airing, and specifically roughly 1.5 minutes had been cut out of it without his knowledge or consent. These were the comments during which Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman's voice had been truncated and altered as she spoke about the firings of Bernard White, Sharan Harper, and Valerie Van Isler. And also the other remove sound was the voice of Interim General Manager Yatrice Lead as she made on-air comments in the early morning of December 23rd about the takeover of WBAI. So that was early last week. Then on Friday, we got word that unpaid staffer Rachel Barr has been banned from WBAI. Rachel is the fifth member of WBAI's popular morning show Wake Up Call to be banned or fired since the takeover of the station by Pacifica. And then, as reported in the newspaper Haiti Progrès, Interim General Manager Yatrice Lead also attempted to fire Robert Knight from his morning news spot on Wake Up Call. Knight is an award-winning producer of WBAI's Earthwatch, and along with Valerie Van Isler and Bernard White, a 20-year veteran of the station. So we have that development. Then this morning in New York Newsday, we had this story, the ongoing turmoil. This is by staff writer Peter Goodman. The ongoing turmoil at listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 spilled onto the air yesterday when Amy Goodman, longtime co-host of the morning show Wake Up Call, was cut off during the broadcast and threatened with firing. Goodman is one of two surviving members of the program after a Christmas coup in which a new station manager was named and several veteran staffers were dismissed. The National Board of the Pacifica Foundation, which owns WBAI, has been trying to exert control over a five-station network traditionally based on listener support and local control. According to accounts provided by Goodman and email from a listener, Goodman had been saying she hoped the fired personnel will be reinstated when new co-host Clayton Riley, after arguing with her about bringing the matter up, ordered her mic cut off. So we have that distressing development. This morning, over at our sister station, WPFW, which is the Washington, D.C. Station of the Pacifica Network, a weekly program which has been playing for over a year. It's called Between the Lines. It's produced by radio producers at the community station WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut. It's nationally syndicated to 12 stations. It covers a range of public affairs issues, and it's a half-hour program. The program was summarily canceled by the WPFW management without any reason given, and this was on the day that a segment had been scheduled to air, and of course will be airing at the other affiliates of this program, concerning the crisis at WBAI. And this was a segment that included an interview with interim station manager at WBAI, Utrice Lead, as well as a segment with Pacifica National Board member Leslie Kagan. This was the second time in a year and a half that a public affairs program had been canceled by WPFW right after a discussion of controversies within the Pacifica Network. According to Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, in a release from December 1999, without notice to producers or listeners, the Washington, D.C.-based Pacifica affiliate WPFW has canceled FAIR's radio show Counterspin, and that is a media criticism show that does run here on WBAI, as well as many other stations around the country, and their release goes on to say it's been censored by Pacifica stations five times this year for covering the ongoing crisis at the network. Now, what's interesting and disturbing is that it was immediately after the cancellation of Counterspin in late 1999 that then WPFW decided to run as a replacement this program Between the Lines that, as I just mentioned, was taken off the air summarily today with no reason given. So we have history repeating itself, censorship piled upon censorship. Finally, we have a very disturbing episode of a producer at WPFW, a producer up until recently, of a kindred spirit program called Heal DC about public health issues by the name of Fatima Sek. And Ms. Sek had been one of the producers on the program for 2 years, and she had produced many well-respected programs on a range of health issues. She also did programming occasionally on some criminal justice issues. And she went on one of the programs here on WBAI on New Year's Day to discuss her views of the crisis in the station here, because she's a born and raised New Yorker. And upon her exit from the studio, she was told by Pacifica Executive Director Bessie Wash that she would not be returning to her program. So we do see this very disturbing pattern going on throughout the network, and of course these are just a few of the examples, really the tip of the iceberg. And with us to discuss the pattern nationally in Pacifica, and also to give us a case study of one of the most fully developed patterns of wiping the airwaves clean of dissenting views, is the situation of our sister station in Houston, KPFT. And we're joined on the line now by Rafael Renteria. Rafael is the former program director and news director at KPFT in Houston. He subsequently moved. He left there about 5 years ago. He subsequently moved to Los Angeles, where today he's on the coordinating committee of the listeners group at another sister station, Pacifica station KPFK, and they're very active in fighting this corporate orientation of the Pacifica National Board. Rafael, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here. How are you?
Okay. Tell us about the transformation of the Pacifica station in Houston throughout the 1990s and how it changed from this vibrant mosaic of many racial and ethnic groups and people of different genders and sexualities and a whole wide range of public affairs issues to the overwhelming music and mainstream public affairs that you have today.
Well, I was program director at KPFT in the 1970s, in the late 1970s. And at that point in Houston, it was a time of tremendous upsurge politically, along with the revolution in Nicaragua, the revolution in Iran. There was just a lot of upsurge in Houston locally. There had been a murder of a Chicano man, much of the kind of thing that you've seen in New York a lot lately. Houston has a very brutal police department. They killed a fellow named Jose Campos Torres, and they fined the cops a dollar. Well, there was a riot. And what that created was real opening. It was right before the Reagan era, and there was just a tremendous lifting of the lid, so to speak, and a hopefulness that swept through Houston. We took advantage of it to really transform the city. And the city was also becoming, was in the early stages of becoming an international city, and so we paid a lot of attention to what was going on, and by the time we were done with setting a new direction for the programming, we broadcasted in nine different languages. By the time that trend had fulfilled itself, it was 11 different languages, and KPFT had attained the highest level of diversity that the Pacifica Network had ever seen. Well, that direction for the programming lasted for about 12 or 13 years, and basically we had established that, and there's a fellow who had come aboard KPFT. His name was Garland Ganter. And Garland had worked at a radio station, basically it was across the street from KPFT, called KTRH. And KTRH was one of those staid, reactionary news talk radio stations. And Garland was a pretty stiff and starchy kind of guy, and he came aboard as news director. Well, eventually, over the course of the last 15 years or so, or 17 years, whatever it's been, he has become general manager. And it had played a very, very reactionary role in destroying the diversity at KPFT. And it's interesting, see, because the question of diversity at KPFT has real impact on a larger question within Pacifica itself. KPFT has been held up as a model for what Pacifica is to become. The now former chair of the Pacifica National Board is a woman named Mary Frances Berry. And Dr. Berry is the chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, which has, of course, come to New York and done some would-be investigation of police abuse issues and so forth there in New York City. Well, Berry held up KPFT as a model for what Pacifica should become. And she also has held forth the notion that Pacifica is trying to not mainstream or censor the network, but they're trying to reach a larger audience and trying to actually diversify. Well, if KPFT is a model for that, and if KPFT actually represents what Pacifica is moving toward, and I think it very much does, we're in some trouble. I'll give you an example. Well, the clearest, the essence of the situation is this, that rather than broadcasting in 11 languages, KPFT in Houston now broadcasts in one. KPFT now broadcasts in English only. There is no longer a single public affairs program in the city directed toward black people. Houston has the largest population of black people in the South, larger than Atlanta, larger than New Orleans, Birmingham, or any other city in the South. There's not a single public affairs program directed toward the Latino community, although out of a metropolitan population of 4 million, there are 1 million Latinos in this city. There's a large array of programming that has been axed. There's no longer any locally produced news, which all these things are a direct violation, by the way, of Pacifica's Articles of Incorporation. And, in fact, the National Board has been sued in part over this question of what they've done at KPFT. So there's no longer any public affairs programming in the middle of the day. There's the Persian program, which we founded back during the time of the so-called Iran hostage crisis, when all of this anti-Iranian fever was being whipped up, and you had songs on the in-person program on the air. Well, Garland Ganter took that program off the air at a time when the United States had warships poised in the Persian Gulf ready to attack Iran. That gives you a sense of some of the politics, the extremely reactionary politics behind this. A program called the Arabic Hour, which is one of the most intellectually respectable programs on KPFT, was eliminated during Desert Shield, which was the period when the U.S. was preparing to go to war against Iraq and seize control of the world's oil supply. Gay programming has been significantly cut and very much depoliticized. The atheist program, which was the first program of its kind in the world, is gone. Programs for Pakistanis, for Chinese, for Vietnamese, Native Americans, the bulk of feminist programming has been curtailed. There's certainly no black nationalist programming on the air. And in fact, there's only one program that's really oriented toward black people, and that is an African music program. And it's not even a program for African Americans. I mean, I have nothing against an African music program, you understand, but you have to understand that there is a very large percentage of the population of Houston that is black. The Celtic program is gone. Music of India, which was one of the largest garners of funding for KPFT, is gone. So if this is the model for diversity in Pacifica, and if this is a model for where Pacifica is headed overall, as I was saying, we're in some pretty deep trouble, because this is not a model for diversity. This is a situation in which diversity in programming is being systematically killed, and what these changes represent is really a protracted assault on and a betrayal of the values that Pacifica has embodied since its inception. And what this represents is the essence of something that Pacifica calls its strategic five-year plan, which is a plan for mainstreaming program. This is not a local issue at all. I've got to tell your listeners that of course people are concerned about the replacement of Valerie Van Isler and the way that it was done. And they're concerned about the significance of the direction that the new interim general manager, Utrecht Lead, is taking. But this is way, way more than a local issue. This is way, way more than a violation of due process within WBAI itself. And it's way more than a labor issue. And it's way more than Bernard White. And frankly, to tell you the truth, it's even way more than Amy Goodman. People throughout the Pacifica Network, I don't have any sense of how people in WBII look at this or realize how much Amy Goodman is adored and is viewed as a hero throughout the Pacifica Network and through all of its affiliates, and people paying very, very close attention to the question of Amy Goodman. There have been demonstrations around the country in defense of Amy. And in fact, one of the most recent abuses at KPFT is a fellow named George Reiter, who was a professor of physics at the University of Houston, who was doing a progressive program on KPFT. And when he participated in a demonstration in defense of Amy, he was fired from the airwaves recently in the last couple of months. So people are paying very close attention.
Raphael, let me just interrupt. I'm sorry to emphasize the point that the professor whose program was removed was not even speaking at the demonstration. He simply walked a picket line that was
right.
One of five around the country in response to reports that Amy Goodman had filed a charge of harassment, gender harassment, and censorship against the national management of the Pacifica Foundation. And this was to express outrage that she was being pressured either to change her content or to be relieved of her job.
Well, yeah, and specifically the change of the content, of course, is an interesting question, because it segues with all the other changes that Pacific has been making in the network. They were telling her to lay off of Mark Shubb, the general manager of KPFK here in Los Angeles, where I live, had told Amy that people don't want to hear about police brutality before breakfast. And in my mind, that a man can, with that mentality, can even exist within the Pacifica Network, much less be a leading figure and administrator within it, is a travesty and indicates a whole lot about where this network is going. So people are paying very close attention to the elimination of those who are close to Amy, the elimination of people who work with her on Wake Up Call, the attack on Robert Knight, Bernard White, and so But in any case, the situation is larger than just Amy, even, because the strategic five-year plan is a plan that, in its origin, in its effect, and really in its essence, is racist and classist. And you've got to realize that, you know, similar to the less drastic changes have occurred throughout much of the network, as have happened at KPFT, including the virtual elimination of Spanish language programming at Pacifica's Los Angeles station, KPFK, which has the largest concentration, of course, of Spanish-speaking people in the United States, and the elimination of a lot of the more black radical programmers at KPFA in Berkeley. 5 years ago, there was a series of purges throughout most of the Pacifica network, and an effort at KPFA and at KPFK to bust the unions. And Pacifica has recently hired on its national board, or brought into its national board, rather, a fellow whose law firm specializes in union busting, a fellow named John Murdoch, who is playing a very important role within the Pacifica National Board. So these things have an overall direction to them, and that is also part of why what happened at KPFA in Berkeley happened. KPFA is the flagship station of the Pacifica Network, and about a year and a half ago, there was a takeover that was done a little bit less subtly than what's happened at WBI. It appears that somebody learned a couple of strategic lessons in having dropped a huge rock on their foot at KPFA. The result of the takeover at KPFA was that 15,000 listeners marched in the streets, and the heat was applied to the Pacifica National Board from just a tremendous array of forces. And Pacifica had taken over KPFA with armed security guards whose website claimed that the outfit had links to the CIA and to the FBI. Mary Frances Berry, again, who is the chair of the...
former chair.
She's the former chair of the Pacifica Network, but she's the chair of the Civil Rights Commission, placed a phone call to the Justice Department and had someone at the Justice Department place a call to the Berkeley police, to lean on the Berkeley police to be more brutal with the protesters, to be rougher, to be more disciplined, more disciplinarians, if you will. It's an odd thing for a civil rights advocate to be doing, don't you think? And so the station was taken over. It was occupied by armed guards. Garland Ganter, again, from KPFT, was shipped out to Berkeley to take over as interim manager. Dennis Bernstein, who many of your listeners at WBI will recall, has been a programmer there at WBI in the past, and does a program now that is highly respected in Berkeley called Flashpoints, was taken off the air, was arrested effectively, or chased on mic, and basically told that he was being fired and banned from the station on the microphone. So all these things are consistent, and they're all part of a plan, Pacifica's part, called the Strategic Five-Year Plan. And the five-year plan has roots, of course, somewhere. It's not just something somebody thought up, you know, willy-nilly. It is a vision, basically, that is just, and you can look for this on the Pacifica website, actually. They also call it the vision document. And it is basically a document that pretends to make Pacifica into a much more mainstream radio network. It orients itself toward trying to grab significant sectors of the news talk listenership of mainstream radio throughout the country and tailor itself to those people. It is a document that intends to drive Pacifica in the direction of becoming more influential within the beltway of Washington, D.C.
Raphael, I'm very sorry to have to interrupt, but we are running out of time. So why don't you just close with a one-minute statement of what you think is the hope for the future to reclaim the original mission that the foundation's founder, Lou Hill, had for Pacifica more than 50 years ago. How can we get it back on course?
Well, there's a couple of things. There's a lawsuit that I personally favor called the Listener Lawsuit. The Attorney General of California authorized listeners to sue Pacifica in his name. And the Listener Lawsuit called... board, which it provides accountability for the network for the first time.
I'm very sorry, Rafael Renteria. We're going to have to leave it there. There are a range of strategies that people are pursuing at all five stations and across the country to reclaim the Pacifica network. And I want to thank our guest, Rafael Renteria, the former program and news director at the Pacifica station in Houston and currently active with the Listeners Council in the Pacifica station in Los Angeles. Thank you very much for joining us. And for people who want to get involved here locally in the efforts to reclaim the network and reverse the takeover that occurred here over Christmas weekend, they can get involved with Concerned Friends of WBAI, which is having its next rally to reclaim the station on this Wednesday, tomorrow, from 4 to 7 p.m. in front of the station, 120 Wall Street, just east just near the East River. And in addition, there are two rallies in Washington in conjunction with the inauguration weekend and all the anti-Bush activity going on. This Friday at noon, a rally outside the offices of Epstein, Becker, and Green. That's the law firm that Rafael mentioned. One of the Pacifica board members is employed there. That's the union-busting lawyers. And then on Sunday, a rally at 1 p.m. outside Pacifica National Headquarters in Washington. For more information on all of this, you can call the Concerned Friends hotline at 800-825-0055. Once again, that's 800-825-0055. And there are buses going down to D.C. on both Friday and Saturday, and you can get information about that from there. For more information on the web, you can go to www.savepacifica.net. And if you want to read that five-year plan that Rafael mentioned, you can go to the Pacifica website at pacifica.org. And finally, I just want to mention that I had a mass meeting last week by over 200 listeners and producers. A major statement of demands on the Pacifica Network was adopted that will, we hope, if accepted by the Foundation, will reclaim the original mission of this network and bring us back on course as a genuinely listener-supported, non-commercial, community-based radio network. For my co-host, Kathy Davis, and myself, Bob Lederer, and I want to thank our engineer. Good afternoon.
Palestinian reality? What's really happening in the Muslim lands? A new memoir by Professor Leila Ahmed? Or